Santa Monica?
She went up to Santa Monica. So I believe that we will be hearing a whole lot about Santa Monica because Johnny was right here with me when we started this from the beginning. And I believe that she went up there, her and her husband and her uncle and another gentleman. And I believe that the four of them are going to create in Santa Monica the same thing we have created here in San Diego.
Which is an expanded protest, which...
An expanded protest to help the people in Santa Monica as well as they're going here. And if I have my way, once this year-round transitional housing is done here, I'm going north. I'm going to hit every city from here to San Francisco.
We'll be waiting for you in Santa Cruz there, Roger.
I'll be up there.
All right.
All right, buddy.
I believe in the revolution. We have routed out the old tyrants, and now we have new tyrants. But still, I believe in the revolution. The spoils have been grabbed by businessmen, middlemen, financiers, salesmen, operators, manipulators. But the revolution must continue.
You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrob Spear Robert Norris, from 6 to 8 on Thursdays and from 11 to 1:30 in the afternoon on Sundays. You can hear the show. You can actually join in the show if you'd like to be a part of it. Our call-in number here in the studio, 423-5361. We cover issues of civil rights for the poor, homelessness, and we've also been focusing of late on issues that are of interest even to the broader community directly, such as redevelopment of the beach flats, the Seaside Company giveaway. In fact, later in the show, we're hoping to play tape by Phil Baer, his latest update on what's going on around the beach flats. I took a trip down to Cabrillo College a couple days ago in order to find the New Scientist magazine. It's a kind of a popular science magazine published in England, and I saw it referred to in High Times, of course, which is the monthly slick pro-marijuana magazine, actually kind of very glitzy treatment of marijuana and other recreational drugs, but it also, of late in the last couple of years, has had a good, strong support for folks fighting for basic civil rights in terms of the drug prohibition war that we're now in the midst of and have suffered so many casualties because of. And they mentioned this New Scientist article, so I kind of looked around for it and found it. And there's a very interesting editorial as well as a series of, research conclusions. Under Science and Technology News, there's this editorial by David Kankar that I'm going to read you, called High Anxieties, What the World Health Organization Doesn't Want You to Know About Cannabis. Health officials in Geneva have suppressed the publication of a politically sensitive analysis that confirms what aging hippies have known for decades. Cannabis is safer than alcohol or tobacco. According to a document leaked to New Scientist, the analysis concludes not only that the amount of dope smoked worldwide does less harm to public health than drink and cigarettes, but that the same is likely to hold true even if people consume dope on the same scale as these legal substances. The comparison is due to appear in a report on the harmful effects of cannabis published last December by the World Health Organization, but it was ditched at the last minute following a long and intense dispute between WHO officials, the cannabis experts who drafted the report, and a group of external advisors. As the WHO's first report on cannabis for 15 years, the document had been eagerly awaited by doctors and specialists in drug abuse. The official explanation for excluding the comparison of dope with legal substances is that, quote, the reliability and public health significance of such comparisons are doubtful. However, insiders say that the comparison was scientifically sound and that the WHO, World Health Organization, caved in to political pressure. It is understood that advisors from the U.S. National Institute on Drug Abuse and the UN International Drug Control Program warned the WHO that it would play into the hands of groups campaigning to legalize marijuana. One member of the expert panel, which drafted the report, says, in the eyes of some, any such comparison is tantamount to an argument for marijuana legalization. Another member, Billy Martin of the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, says that some World Health Organization officials went nuts when they saw the draft report. The leaked version of the excluded section states that the reason for making the comparisons was, quote, not to promote one drug over another, but rather to minimize the double standards that have operated in appraising the health effects of cannabis. Nevertheless, in most of the comparisons it makes between cannabis and alcohol, the illegal drug comes out better, or at least on a par with the legal one. The report concludes, for example, that, quote, in developed societies, cannabis appears to play a little role in injuries caused by violence, as does alcohol. It also says that while the evidence for fetal alcohol syndrome is good, the evidence that cannabis can harm fetal development is far from conclusive. In other words, it's established for fetal alcohol syndrome, but not for cannabis. Cannabis also fared better in 5 out of 7 comparisons of long-term damage to health. For example, the report says that while heavy consumption of either drug can lead to dependence, only alcohol produces a well-defined withdrawal syndrome. And while heavy drinking leads to cirrhosis, severe brain injury, and a much increased risk of accidents and suicide, the report concludes that there is, quote, only suggestive evidence that chronic cannabis use may produce subtle defects in cognitive functioning. Two comparisons were more equivocal. The report says that both heavy drinking and marijuana smoking can produce symptoms of psychosis in susceptible people. And it says there is evidence that chronic cannabis smoking may be a contributory cause of cancers of the aerodigestive tract. David Konkar, 21st of February, 1998 issue of New Scientist. The New Scientist magazine, it's one I haven't read much before, but and I don't know how reliable it is. It's interesting, certainly. Any thoughts on this? Give a call to 423-5361. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is your radio station, 96.3 FM. And the call-in number here is 423-5361. Another article in the New Scientist was entitled, A Safe High? Marijuana, A Safe High? And the author of that article, I'm looking for it, I'm catching the people who did the photos, but I don't catch the author of the article. Well, I'll read a bit of the article. Cannabis faces serious charges from the U.S. government. You are the jury. Claim 1. Critical skills related to attention, memory, and learning are impaired among heavy users of marijuana. And here is the New Scientist's response. Most people think of marijuana users as dreamers with the attention span of a gnat and no memory worth the name. Wrong. The picture emerging from psychology labs is that there is at most a kernel of truth in this stereotype, while some studies find no evidence of even subtle mental impairment in heavy users. And even those that do are open to a range of interpretations not necessarily worrying to marijuana users. Take the latest findings on which the above claim is based. Harrison Pope and his team at Harvard University compared 65 college students who smoked marijuana daily with a control group of students who smoked it most every other month. After a drug-free day, the subjects completed a range of standard mental tests. Mostly, differences between the two groups were slight. When it came to remembering lists of words, for example, the heavy users recalled about 1 in 10 fewer words than the light users. But in one test, the heavy users underperformed more noticeably. The test involved watching and mimicking the simple rules used by an experimenter to match cards with colored shapes on them, and then adapting whenever the rule changed. Students who rarely smoked marijuana mistakenly carried on with the old sorting rule on about 5 out of 100 occasions, while heavy users made about 8 out of 100 occasion mistakes. Pope takes this seriously. In the real world, he says, people have to deal all the time with situations in which the rules are changing. Fine. But over the years, much stronger claims have surfaced. Heavy marijuana users do badly at work or school, are more likely to be delinquent or develop psychiatric problems, or have abnormal brain waves. Time and again, however, such studies encounter the same objection. Are the problems caused by smoking marijuana, or is it just that people with problems are more likely to end up using marijuana heavily? In the case of delinquency, schizophrenia, and mental illness, the balance of the evidence points to the second explanation. Marijuana doesn't cause the problems, although it may make them worse. Some schizophrenics, for example, are drawn to the drug because it eases their sense of alienation. And most researchers now accept that the evidence linking marijuana to abnormal brain waves vanishes when people with psychiatric problems, illnesses, or a history of general drug abuse are excluded from the studies. But what about subtler problems like the card sorting deficiencies? After all, it might just be that smart college students tend to smoke lightly while others smoke heavily, in which case the card sorting results may have little to do with marijuana. Here opinions diverge. Pope believes the deficiency does have something to do with marijuana because his team controlled for such obvious things as IQ differences, psychiatric histories, and heavy use of other drugs. But others are not convinced. What worries some critics is that in this study, as in others, the women drug users did so much better than the men in most tests. I know of no reason why there should be a gender difference in cognitive response to cannabis, says John Morgan, a pharmacologist at the City University of New York Medical School and co-author of a controversial new book advocating decriminalization, Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts. Morgan believes the reason the males underperform in such studies is that they are deviant in subtle ways that escape the researchers' notice. And what if the poor test results do turn out to be linked to marijuana? It doesn't automatically follow that heavy marijuana usage is causing long-lasting brain damage. One possibility is that, deprived of their favorite drug for a day, heavy users suffer withdrawal symptoms or become so grumpy and distracted that they do badly in tests. Another is that a single drug-free day is not long enough for the effect of their last smoke to have disappeared. The Harvard team's follow-on experiments, which marijuana users are being tested over a 28-day dry period, should provide answers. Other research suggests that evidence of dramatic mental decline is unlikely to be found even as a result of long-term heavy use. Over the past 25 years, Jack Fletcher at the University of Texas in Houston and his colleagues have been visiting Costa Rica to test the mental skills of some very heavy users. Although some of them have smoked 10 joints a day for more than 30 years, their ability to learn and remember lists of words is only mildly impaired. And even when struggling with more demanding tasks, such as recalling information while pressing a tapper as fast as possible, their scores fall well within the normal range. The effects are subtle and subclinical, says Brian Page, an anthropologist from the University of Miami who is involved in the study. Although they could be bad for somebody who's trying to be an arbitrage trader or Wall Street lawyer, and Page adds, people who sell bicycles had better not ride them while under the influence. Or at any rate, common sense suggests they should not. The verdict from research into the impact of marijuana on road safety skills is less clear. In Britain, as many as 1 in 10 motorists involved in serious accidents test positive for cannabis, and figures as high as 37% have emerged from studies in urban areas of the U.S. However, many of these drivers also test positive for alcohol, and even the cases involving just cannabis cannot be equated with people driving under the influence because the drug lingers so long in the body. In driving simulators, marijuana does impair visual skills and mental dexterity, but studies of actual driving show that even high doses of marijuana have less impact than alcohol, perhaps because smoking it doesn't usually make people so reckless. In one study, low doses of marijuana made drivers more cautious. The same broad message is likely to be true for the subtler, longer-lasting effects of marijuana on the brain. Researchers like Pope and Morgan may look at the data very differently, but they agree about one thing. Heavy boozing is worse for your neurons than dope. That's a story in the New Scientist, 21st of February, 1998. If you want to read this yourself, check it out at the Cabrillo College Library, which is open throughout the summer, in the summer session, particularly on the weekdays. There's other claims. More than 120,000 people in the U.S. seek treatment each year for their marijuana addiction, is a claim made by anti-marijuana, pro-prohibition people in the government. Here's what New Scientist says. After years of decline, marijuana use among teenagers is now climbing rapidly in almost every industrialized nation. Will this create a generation of cannabis addicts? The middle classes who enjoy a smoke once or twice a week may laugh at the idea, but doctors who treat the minority of users who have lost control take it more seriously. The pragmatic question is, how big is this minority, and would it expand if the drug was decriminalized or even legalized, or re-legalized, as some say? The experience of the Netherlands suggests the answer to the second question is no. The first question, how big is this minority, is tougher. At the very least, NIDA's figure of 120,000 cannot be taken seriously. It includes people who are arrested for cannabis offenses and then given the chance of going into treatment as an alternative to prosecution, as well as workers who test positive for cannabis in random urine tests and opt for rehabilitation rather than being fired. The figures don't tell us how many people really get hooked. At Columbia University in New York, addiction epidemiologist Denise Kandel has been taking a different tack. She has been analyzing data collected every year in the U.S. National Household Survey on Drug Abuse, and she concludes that subtle symptoms of dependence are now more widespread among teenage users than previously thought. About 15% of teenagers who smoke marijuana report three or more, quote, symptoms of dependence from a list of six possible symptoms. They range from feeling dependent or being unable to cut down on consumption to using ever larger amounts of cannabis to get the same effect. Applying these same measures to alcohol, it turns out that marijuana is just as addictive as alcohol for adults, and even more so for teenagers. That shocks most marijuana users, but not Kandel, who believes kids may be unusually sensitive to marijuana for biological as well as social reasons. The way she sees it, the reason we have so many alcoholics is simply that there are so many people drinking. The problem with this kind of research is that it depends on what is meant by addiction. A drug addict is usually seen as a person liable to both withdrawal symptoms and long-term damage to their health. But Kandel's self-report criteria are based on a broader definition. If we applied them to coffee, vast numbers of us would qualify as addicts. Similarly, many people might describe themselves as addicted to shopping or television or chocolate. Kandel's analysis suggests young marijuana smokers are more likely to show symptoms of dependence than their beer-swilling contemporaries, but it doesn't tell us which substance is the more dangerously addictive. What is clear is that as users enter their 20s, they report this dependence far less frequently. And of the people who are still smoking the drug in their 50s, fewer than 1 in 30 qualify in her analysis as being dependent. Addiction rates for nicotine follow the opposite trend. This leads to what is perhaps the most telling statistic about the addictive powers of cannabis. More than 90% of people who have used the drug have long since quit. While most people continue drinking and cigarette smoking long after the first flush of youth, people drop the weed in droves after the age of 30. Government claim number 3, smoking marijuana can lead to abnormal functioning of lung tissue. Smoking a couple of joints is as bad for your lungs as consuming a whole packet of cigarettes, say the Anti-Dope Brigade. Their opponents say smoking marijuana has never caused anyone to die from lung cancer. So is marijuana smoke more or less dangerous than tobacco smoke? The person to ask is Donald Tashkin, a lung expert at the University of California at Los Angeles. For the past 15 years, Tashkin's team has been keeping a close eye on the respiratory systems of more than 130 regular marijuana smokers, comparing them with groups of people who smoke either just tobacco, tobacco and marijuana, or nothing at all. It's the biggest study of its kind in the world, and the results so far suggest that in some respects, yes, marijuana is more dangerous than cigarettes. But in one important respect, joints may actually be better for you, especially if you're an athlete. First, the bad news. While the cigarette smokers in the study were plowing through 20 or more a day, the marijuana smokers seldom consumed more than 3 or 4 joints. Despite this, the marijuana smokers coughed and wheezed as much as the cigarette smokers. In both groups, about 1 in 5 people complained of coughing up phlegm and suffering bouts of bronchitis. And when it came to cellular damage to the lungs, there was also little to choose between them. Both groups had too many mucus-secreting cells lining their airways and too few hair cells, and both groups showed evidence of abnormalities in cell nuclei and changes in genes known to have an early role in the development of cancer. The similarity may seem puzzling given that the marijuana smokers were consuming so much less plant material, but there are good reasons for it, says Tashkin. The first is that joints yield up to 3 times the tar of cigarettes because they are more loosely packed and don't have filters. The second reason is that marijuana smokers inhale more deeply and hold their breath longer. We actually quantified this and found that the breath-holding time was increased about fourfold, says Tashkin. That resulted in about a 40% greater deposition of tar. Tashkin's final factor, contested by some researchers, is that marijuana smoke is richer in benzopyrene and other polycyclic aromics known to trigger cancerous changes in cells. So smoking marijuana can cause lung cancer after all? Well, maybe. Despite the gloomy cell biology, epidemiologists have so far failed to find a link between marijuana and serious lung diseases. That might be because there isn't one. Or it might be because the marijuana epidemic, as Tashkin likes to call it, is still young and the people who started smoking in the 1960s haven't reached an age when cancers become common. Meanwhile, some researchers are worried about another aspect of marijuana smoke, its ability to interfere with immune cells that help to fight off lung infections. Tashkin's team has just discovered that immune cells isolated from the lungs of marijuana users are unusually bad at killing bacteria, 35% worse, in fact, than similar cells taken from cigarette smokers. The marijuana-exposed cells were also below par, producing molecules needed to mount inflammatory responses. In normal marijuana smokers, the effects may be too slight to make much difference. Tashkin fears, however, that the same may not be true in people with AIDS, many of whom use cannabis to stimulate their appetites. There's some good news, though, for dope-smoking cricketers and footballers. Marijuana smoke won't lead to blocked airways or emphysema. Despite all the cellular changes noted by Tashkin's team, the researchers found that even heavy smoking of marijuana had no impact on any physical measure of lung function. In fact, among their subjects, smoking 3 joints per day caused no greater rate of decline in lung cancer and the ability to breathe than smoking no marijuana per day. And the reason for this silver lining? It could well be back to those sluggish immune cells, speculates Tashkin. If cannabis impairs the ability of immune cells to produce inflammatory cytokines, you might be spared mucosal damage in peripheral airways. Well, we're getting a little technical here, and I've been reading this one for about 15 minutes. There's another claim that's discussed, that marijuana causes long-term changes in the brain similar to those seen in other drugs of abuse. And let's see, that claim is, I believe, disputed by this study. So it seems like a balanced treatment. It sounds like the New Scientist is trying to present the evidence fairly. Again, it's hard to tell because in order to really adequately understand and research this kind of stuff, you have to read a lot more, and you have to go back to the original studies and look at them. There's also an article in the same 21st of February, 98, New Scientist called The Dutch Experiment. Go ahead, ask a cop for dope. The Dutch don't mind. And I'll read a little bit about that. It is a weird experience. You walk up to a Dutch policeman and ask where to get some marijuana. You are smilingly directed to the nearest coffee shop, where the menu offers everything from cannabinoid to something called space cake to Northern Lights, a local weed. In much of the world, this could never happen. The penalties for using cannabis are severe. But in 1976, the Dutch legalized the possession of small amounts. What has happened since? Some say that crime has soared, school children drop out, and heroin addiction is rife. Others insist that the Netherlands is a stone paradise of peace and love. I've visited their parks. Their children walk around like zombies, says Lee Brown, head of the U.S. Office for National Drug Control Policy. Hard drug use, heroin and cocaine, has declined substantially, counters Paul Hager of the Indiana Civil Liberties Union. Most comments seem to depend on the speaker's politics. So what is the truth about the great Dutch cannabis experiment? There was no immediate increase in cannabis use after 1976, when cannabis became legalized, says Arjan Sass of the Center for Drug Research at the University of Amsterdam. Trends in use have generally been the same as in other countries. The percentage who regularly use either cannabis or hard drugs is lower in the Netherlands than in many European countries, including Britain, and the number of hard drug addicts in the Netherlands has not increased for a decade, while their average age is rising. Dutch statistics, however, are far from conclusive. The first national study of drug use from the Netherlands is only just being done. There have been smaller-scale studies of particular towns or age groups, but comparing them is fraught with statistical problems. Nonetheless, Dirk Korf of the Institute of Criminology at the University of Amsterdam has used the smaller studies to estimate that 3% of the Dutch people had used cannabis at least once in 1970, rising to 12% in 1991. The best guess for 1998 is 14%. Most of that increase, says Korf, is because lifetime use figures are cumulative. People who had used it in 1970 are still around and are joined by younger users over time. More to the point, he says, is to compare the number of teenagers who start using cannabis. In 1970, he estimates that 20% of all Dutch 18-year-olds surveyed had used it at least once. In 1980, that had fallen to 15%. By 1987, it was 18%, an increase, Korf says, that mirrors the increase in the number of coffee shops in the mid-1980s. Now, about 30% of some Dutch 18-year-olds are said to have tried cannabis, though some researchers think this is an overestimate based on studies of Amsterdam where coffee shops abound. But did more people try cannabis after it was legalized? It seems so. At the Center for Drug Research, Sass and Peter Cohen divided Amsterdammers surveyed in 1987, 1990, and 1994 into two groups, those that were born before 1958, who were 18 or older in 1976, and those who were born after 1976 for whom cannabis has always been legal. Only 19% of the oldies had tried cannabis compared with 38% of the younger group. That difference could be partly misleading. Dutch surveys show that the vast majority of people who use cannabis do so almost exclusively in their 20s. The drug became common in the Netherlands in the mid-1960s, so for the older group members who are already more than 30, it was too late. Nonetheless, the data suggests that more people did try cannabis after decriminalization. But what counts, though, says Sass, is how many continue to use it. In Amsterdam, 55% of people who say they have tried cannabis only end up using it a couple of dozen times or less. The rest may have used it more often, but more than half of them have not used it in the past month. The data shows, says Sass, that legalizing cannabis may make you more likely to try it, but it does not make it more likely that you will continue to use it. But it is by no means certain that the first half of that conclusion is correct. Korf says that the surveys of the number of Germans who used cannabis virtually parallels the peaks and troughs in Dutch surveys between 1970 and 1990, even though Germany has prohibited cannabis throughout the period. Surveys of young Americans in the 1970s and 1980s found substantially higher prevalence rates than in Holland, peaking at 50% of high school seniors in 1980, although the U.S. was strongly prohibitionist. Since then, says Korf, there has been no discernible differences in use between the U.S. states that have decriminalized and those that have not. While cannabis use has increased in the U.S. and Western Europe since 1990, regardless of the legal framework, there is no appreciable causal connection between the Dutch decriminalization of cannabis and the rate at which cannabis use has evolved, Korf concludes. Last year, Robert McCoon at the University of California at Berkeley and Peter Reuter at the University of Maryland compared trends in cannabis use in the U.S., Norway, which bans it, and the Netherlands, where it's legal. They also concluded the reductions in criminal penalties have little effect on drug use, at least for marijuana. While the 1976 legislation may have had little effect on cannabis use, how effective has it been in its main goal of keeping people off harder drugs? The Netherlands has fewer addicts per capita than Italy, Spain, Switzerland, France, or Britain, and far fewer than the United States. Fritz Nack of the Trimbos Institute in Utrecht, the Dutch National Institute for Mental Health and Addiction, says the number of hard drug addicts in the country has been the same for a decade because fewer young people are joining their ranks. The average Dutch junkie is now 44 years old, and only 0.3% of Dutch teenagers had tried cocaine in 1994, compared with 1.7% in the U.S. In the Netherlands, virtually everyone who uses drugs tries cannabis first, and many seem content to go no further. Cannabis addiction and other problems are uncommon. The number of cannabis users treated in drug outpatient facilities is low, says Nack. In 1996, there were only 2,000 patients in the whole country, just 0.3% of all Dutch cannabis users. Of those, 42% also are having trouble with alcohol or other drugs. The rest just usually need counseling to help change their lifestyle, says Sass. Most people who find cannabis causing trouble with concentration or memory at work or school, he says, apply rules like no smoking on weeknights, or they limit their intake. This self-policing seems to work. Dutch teenagers get among the highest scores in the world on international science and mathematics tests. If there are serious problems caused by legalizing marijuana, then 20 plus years of the Dutch experiment has not revealed what they are. Again, all of these articles are from the New Scientist, February 21st, 1998, not on sale, but certainly available at the Cabrillo Library. So check it out. We got some good news and some bad news on marijuana health effects, but generally it looks like it's good news. And of course, the political nonsense continues with the suppression of this kind of information and the attempt to censor the World Health Organization's releasing this study. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrob Spears Broadsides, your weekly, actually twice weekly show. We're on every week at 6 on Thursday and on 11 o'clock in the morning on Sundays. And our phone lines, in case you want to join this discussion, perhaps reveal your own experiences with marijuana and problems you've been having. We can help you to break the habit. Just send all your dope here to Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can give a call to 423-5361.
Oh, old Mara, you lie prostrate, while others are gambling with France's fate. Your words have turned into a flood, which covers all France with people's blood. Oh, Mara, you lie prostrate, while others are gambling with France's fate. Oh, Mara, Mara, you lie prostrate.
Well, they don't just make musicals like they used to. Actually, they call the Marat Saad a musical is going a bit far. Peter Weiss's extravaganza from the mid-60s about the debate between the Marquis de Sade and Jean-Paul Marat, the French revolutionary who was stabbed in his bath by Charlotte Corday in 1793. Maybe taking things a little too far. It was more than a musical. It was musical, political extravaganza, dialogue, advocacy, journalism, who knows. Speaking of advocates, our next interview is with Kate Wells. Kate frequently appears on this show, or her voice does. She's a local attorney who, sort of a rarity, has some credibility with authorities. She's been on the school board out in Soquel until recently and got a favorable write-up in the Santa Cruz Sentinel from Karen Clark, the Sentinel writer notorious for smearing sleeping ban repeal initiative campaign efforts. In fact, those of you who have been following the sleeping ban initiative repeal may note the last thing that appeared in the Sentinel talked again about the camping ban, which has been a particularly bugaboo for those of us who feel describing our initiative that way is a way of distorting and destroying it, because many people who feel that camping should be restricted and controlled and even banned cannot agree that that should also happen to sleeping, and yet that is what does happen under our existing 6.36.010 ordinance. We're also hoping to have a kind of a dialogue with one of the strong, articulate, and still undefeated, he hasn't conceded defeat anyway, advocates for the sleeping ban repeal, David Silva. First, let's hear a bit from Kate Wells on a number of issues.
Wells, attorney at law in Santa Cruz.
Hey, hello.
And Kate, you're, fresh from the blush and glow of a court victory in the case of Jerry Henry. Give us a little background. What was Jerry accused of? Why should we be interested in this particular victory?
Well, this is a large victory for civil rights in terms of the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center and the Aptos in general, a vindication of the Pruneyard decision as far as I'm concerned. Jerry was charged basically...
what was the Pruneyard decision before we go any further?
Well, the Pruneyard decision is a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that basically states that shopping centers are places that are public meeting areas. And, for instance, this is particularly true about Aptos. For instance, it has no central meeting area, no town square or anything. And in fact, if that shopping center wasn't there, that probably would be kind of like a town square. So they have put the onus on these shopping centers, if they're going to take up this space for commercial purposes, that they should allow for the free flow and exchange of ideas as if it were, in fact, somewhat of a village meeting area. They are, after all, reaping the benefits of having usurped that land for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So, at any rate, Jerry has been actively asserting those constitutional rights at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center.
Jerry is the sort of street minister who's been harassed by Deputy Thurber and other folks out
there. Sergeant Hartzer, hounded unmercifully by First Alarm Security.
Primarily because he's been advising young people of their rights in what is apparently an ongoing war between the merchants out there and the young people and their desire to drive everybody without a credit card undercover. Huh?
That's absolutely correct. The kids were committing, you know, such heinous crimes as playing hacky sack and playing their guitars. I mean, after all, they could be somewhere, you know, shooting up heroin or something.
Well,
and wouldn't be bothering anybody.
There is a drug issue. I understand that one woman was given a ticket for lighting a cigarette and then her boyfriend jailed for commenting on the issue.
Right, and she happens to be 22 years old. it's an absolute outrage, you know, and I think a very good reflection of how much our society really doesn't like children, doesn't like kids. And Jerry likes kids, and he counsels them, and I have had several of their parents actually come up to me on the street and say, "You're Jerry Henry's attorney," and say, "Yes," and they say, "Thank you so much." They'll shake my hand and say, "You know, my son was a heroin addict until he met Jerry. And Jerry's turned him around. He doesn't allow any drugs. He doesn't, you know, in short, they should be pinning a medal on him."
Civil liberties, yes. Drugs, no. That's the Henry position?
That's correct. And
what about civil liberties for drug users? Aha!
That's you know, a different issue.
That's another hat.
Okay. That's another show. At any rate, so instead of, in fact, pinning a medal on him, they have, in fact, carried out this this just unmerciful campaign of harassment.
They being merchants and the deputy sheriffs and First Alarm Security?
That is it, a conspiracy between the three of them to make Jerry's life a living hell.
Now, do you have any evidence that there really is a conspiracy? I mean, have you heard of meetings actually between these people?
Yes, secret meetings.
Really?
Secret meetings, yes. Mm-hmm. We were, one of the merchants at the Rancho Del Mar happens to not like this policy that's going on, so they have provided us with information that, yes, there are such secret meetings going on.
A snitch for the people, eh?
A snitch for the people. We like it. Yes. So, at any rate, he was charged variously. In fact, the interesting thing was we had been discussing them dismissing the charges for quite some time, and The
charges, of course, have to do with things like interfering with a business by standing in front of the business.
One of the charges actually has him blocking the doorways of both the coffee roasting company and the Rancho Liquors at the same time.
So he's really kind of a fast character. I thought he was an older man.
Well, he is, and he is he's about 6'1" and weighs maybe 100 pounds.
So he either is very fast or very wide.
I don't know how he would possibly imagine doing such a thing, but that is what the First Alarm Security guard testified to under oath at the suppression motion.
First Alarm Security, which by the way is now almost the monopoly security organization in Santa Cruz with the demise of PSI downtown. But getting back to Aptos and Jerry Henry, go ahead.
Okay, so at any rate, we were discussing them dismissing the charges last week, and we went for a trial readiness conference on, I forget whether it was Thursday or Friday, And indeed, instead of dismissing the charges, they added, I think, three new charges as late as Thursday. And of course, the judge allowed it.
So the DA is colluding with the sheriff's department to run Henry out of the Baptist Shopping Center.
Well, the interesting thing is, she kept saying, well, I have to talk to the merchants and see if they're willing to let these charges go, you know. And I'm going, wait a minute, you're the district attorney. You know, who's running things here? Are the merchants running things, or are you running things?
And who is the district attorney involved in this?
Pardon?
Which district attorney was involved?
Marcia Jubaleo. And but now I have to pay her a compliment in that she was the first. There have been like six district attorneys assigned to this case. She was the first one who actually did go out into the field and interview all of the people.
And what did she find?
Well, guess what? They dismissed the charges on Monday.
They did. And did you talk to her about the reason for this?
Yes, we discussed the reasons. At first, actually, we discussed it all weekend. At first they were going to require Jerry to sign a letter that,
he would be a good boy?
It stated as follows. It stated that, it is the policy of Gottschalk's Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center to not allow persons to sit on, lean against, or climb on their building. And that, Henry would agree to that policy, and they would agree to enforce that policy in a non-discriminatory manner.
Mm-hmm.
We were all for that because for us it just showed how absolutely ridiculous Gottschalk's is. At any rate...
It sounds like the City Council of Santa Cruz, which their sit-lie-law bans.
Oh, yeah, almost worse, you know. It's just, anyway. We were actually willing to do that, but we wanted them to sign as well, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
When we got there Monday morning, all ready to do this, they didn't have the representative from Gottschalk's to sign this. And I said, well, we're not signing it without Gottschalk's. And so I guess what happened is they delayed the court, I'm not sure what happened. I was not privy to what happened, but when we got back that afternoon, Marcia was ready to and did, in fact, drop all the charges.
So that nothing has been signed. It seems to me that, you know, it may be the policy of Gottschalk's to shoot everybody with pink hair.
Exactly.
But that makes no difference.
Has no legal import whatsoever.
To our civil rights in that area, our civil liberties in public spaces. And how's Jerry doing? Is he still out there in that area? And is he being supported by young people and by attorneys like yourself? And
he
by
had 40 witnesses subpoenaed for that trial.
Isn't this a case of exhausting you? I mean, they arrest him, they bring him to court, they run through the mill, they bring him to court appearance after court appearance.
That's it.
Then they drop it. Now, is he going to sue and do a civil suit for damages? Does he have any basis for doing that? What's our real remedy? I mean, tomorrow they may arrest him again on the same charge and run him through the same mill and then drop the charges again.
Well, funny you should ask. I have it on pretty good authority that yes, there is going to be a Title 42 action filed. They actually, in going back over you saying this...
A 42 action, of course, is a civil rights action?
Civil rights action, yes, that will charge the Sheriff's Department, the Gottschalk's Department, it's the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. By the way, the piling on charges at the end were that he was interfering with the business of the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center, which I think is pretty interesting because I guess the business of Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center is probably leasing businesses.
So she's
Jerry said he promised that he had not interfered with any leasing activity going on.
Now, wait a minute. His being there is an affront to any potential lessee. Therefore, that we have
that,
to say his existence in that area is, in effect, a form of interference.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's, I guess, what they were trying to get at any rate. It hasn't been filed yet, and I hesitate to, you know...
What about getting an injunction against Rancho Del Mar from harassing this man?
Well, that might be part of the action, actually, to bring an injunctive relief action.
But that, wouldn't that be months, if not years, down the road?
But in the meantime, my guess is that they would not be quite so vociferous in their harassment of the young people.
And is that in fact being, I guess since this happened on Monday, I guess we might have some indication. Maybe we should give them a call and find out how the young people are being treated, or maybe I can actually wander on down there and start
talking to Deputy Thurber myself. He and I are old pals, as we
know. Old pals. Actually, Deputy Thurber is assigned to Soquel. I ran into him
You ran into him? Did he survive?
Well, I'll tell you what, he scared the hell out of the person that I was standing there talking to when he drove up.
Did he recognize you?
Oh, yeah, he definitely, he always goes out of his way to come up and say hi to Counselor Wells, yes.
Oh, yes, of course. Well, he says hello to me as well.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say except, get a life, James.
I'm also embroiled in this case where it could erupt into something pretty interesting in terms of this an elderly senior citizen who is disabled having had his car impounded by the Santa Cruz PD for allegedly driving on a suspended license, a charge that was later dropped. But they left this man, who is quite severely handicapped, alongside the road and just took his car. And after they dropped the charges, he tried to get his car back, and they said, well, only if you pay not only these outrageous impound fees, but if you pay the Santa Cruz PD...
booking fees?
For the...
After dropping the charges? No way.
After dropping the charges, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, that's going to be a pretty interesting case. His car is still an impound at this point, and there is... probably some sort of an action in the offing there as well.
Now, what about your rumors that you're going to form a civil rights watchdog group where people can get together, get training in how to defend their civil rights, learn B.E. Smith's tactics for take me to a magistrate, and generally cause some real change in the Santa Cruz courts?
Well, it's actually happening with the decision that came down from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. By the way, this is a very important thing to get to all your listeners. This case did come down that states that if you stop for a traffic violation and you ask to be taken to a magistrate, they can't arrest you for that. in fact, they have to take you to a magistrate. And this decision came down from the Ninth Circuit. It's an excellent decision.
Name of this decision?
Pardon?
What's the case?
Actually, I think that the name of the case is Henry. I think it's Henry. I have the case, and it's a wonderful case. They actually take the time to cite some of the lyrics from Alice's Restaurant, and draw parallels between what happened to Arlo Guthrie.
Now, do you feel strongly enough about this that you, for example,